I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation Cure Master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
All right, it is Thursday, and you're tuned in to the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio Network. We're coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Beautiful sunny day, so excited to be out without a coat on, and also thrilled to be on the line with Fred Magdoff. Fred, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us today. So we have Fred on to talk about a book that he's put together called Agriculture and Food in Crisis, Conflict, Resistance, and Renewal. It's a collection of works that take a global perspective at the current state of our food system. And Fred, I was like scanning through your bio, getting ready for the show, and it's so extensive. I wanted to give you a chance to kind of pull out some highlights for us and tell us a little bit about your work and kind of what led you to the book.
Well, I'm retired from the University of Vermont and do a little bit of teaching, do lecturing and writing now. I'm an adjunct professor at Cornell University, and I worked for many years on soil health, really, or soil fertility. Was my area, and the interaction between the soil and plants. And so I did a lot of work on use of manures, fertilizers, different techniques for improving soil, and I got very interested in soil organic matter and its critical role in the soil, and so and its critical role in promoting soil health. And so I worked in that area for a long time and written a number of articles and books on it. And I'm also interested in the social and political issues. I taught a course that dealt with that here at the University of Vermont. And they are just so important to me, especially after what happened in 2008 with the world food crisis. But I was interested in it even before that time. So the political, economic, and the actual practice of agriculture all interest me.
Yeah, and are all kind of intersecting. I was hoping to kind of start the show, you could talk a little bit about agriculture in higher ed and kind of what does the education look like out there for someone who is interested in going to a you know 2-year or 4-year university to study agriculture? What are the options, and how does the work you're doing now kind of fit into the bigger spectrum of what's available for people to study, what's being taught, who's funding it, that kind of stuff?
Well, I'd say most first off, every state has at least one agricultural school that is a state school. Like Cornell for New York State is the state agricultural college is at Cornell, and in Vermont it's the University of Vermont. In Connecticut it's UConn, University of Connecticut, and every state has at least one, and sometimes they have more than one.
And those are all the land grant institutions.
Those are the land grant institutions.
Right.
That's right. They were funded initially with land grants from Congress. To teach and to do research initially to teach and then do research and extension. So I would say that most of the education that goes on is fairly conventional. That is, it's teaching about agriculture, I would say, the conventional agriculture, where you're growing commodities usually in fairly large scale, and you're using the traditional, what has become a traditional package of inputs, fertilizers, pesticides, seeds from companies like Monsanto, etc. There are, though, who I'm sure in many of the schools, there are people who are very interested in sustainable agriculture and alternative agriculture and doing things differently for lots of reasons, which we can talk about if you'd like. So, you know, I think you need to check in and make sure, find out what the orientation is if you are interested in studying agriculture, and check and make sure what types of courses are being taught and what's the orientation of the people that are teaching them and of the department. There are definitely some that what I would call more progressive than others.
Right. And have you seen, I'm just wondering, you've been in, you know, higher ed for, what is it, 30? for a long time. For long enough to kind of maybe,
close to 40.
Yeah, yeah, maybe see some shifts. And I'm just to get at like more of a historical perspective. The course material, I mean, has it changed? Do you see it changing from when you first got into the field? Kind of what's the ebb and flow?
Well, yeah, sure, it's changed. I mean, we've learned more. I mean, many things that I learned as a student, and I taught initially when I came here, I found out just happened not to be true. You know, so you know, the agriculture is still a relatively young science, and so clearly, you know, things have changed. I would say also you have more of an understanding of the problems of the conventional agricultural system as it developed in the United States. The multiple problems: water pollution, excess use of pesticides, contamination of food with pesticides, the overuse of antibiotics. I can go into them all if you're interested. But there is growing understanding that there are problems with that system, and so there are people on many of the campuses, professors I'm talking about, that mm-hmm. are interested in working in alternative systems, alternative ways of doing things. And that includes also alternative ways of, you know, interacting with the market instead of just selling completely to a wholesaler. There's a movement now to, as I'm sure you and your listeners are aware, to sell locally. To know who's buying your food, and so they should know who their farmer is, and so there are different ways of selling now that were very unusual before they become fairly common. So, I would say things are shifting. I don't think they've shifted anywhere near far enough at the university level, but the change happens very slowly in that level.
Yeah, I think a lot of our guests and a lot of the people we've been lucky enough to kind of have here on the show are definitely farmers or young people interested in getting into farms, but are definitely coming at things from a much smaller scale. So I think it's always interesting to kind of get the broader perspective if you're thinking about really the majority of food that's produced in the U.S. and in the world, and how you essentially, as advocates, kind of work to change in that environment, and what role education can play, but then also what is the role for New Yorkers? What can us kind of city folk look to? We can definitely vote with our dollar and spend our money at the farmer's market, but are there other things from your perspective that we should be aware of or be thinking about to kind of create change in that environment?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are different limitations. We certainly know how to grow food in an ecologically sound way. Okay, that, by the way, when that is done, in almost all cases, the yields are actually higher than they would be if they were grown conventionally on large-scale operations. So the practice of what you might call sustainable agriculture, or organic agriculture, or organic plus agriculture is known. So one of the problems is that farmers in this field have a hard time making money unless they're doing some value-added products of their own. For example, you know, a farmer in the Hudson Valley who's growing produce and brings it down to New York City or, I don't know, to Albany or wherever, usually those people are not making enough money, really, to pay themselves a decent wage, pay their laborers decent wage, have health insurance, put enough money away for their retirement, etc. So it's a tough road. Unless you have even the CSAs, the Community Supported Agriculture, and I know that there are some delivering to New York City, even those the farmers don't make, well, some do and some don't, but I would say a lot don't make enough to really cover their expenses if you include retirement as part of their expenses.
Right, right. And there is this kind of weird idea that farmers should be poor, or, I mean, they're, right. That's, you know, like, where did that come from? Why is that, like, I mean, that's the expectation, right? Like,
well, yeah, there's a cheap food, you know, the United States has had a cheap food policy, and it has produced cheap food. We can talk about whether it's healthy or not, it's a whole other story, but it's fairly inexpensive. It's going up now for reasons we can talk about. I mean, right now, as it did in 2008. But it's, it became possible when you're producing at huge scale with very little labor to produce food fairly cheaply. And so by using the inputs that they were using. So people got used to it. And it is a difficulty. It's a difficulty trying to break in now, although many people are able to do it. They're not really making enough money, at least in my mind. One way they can, and a lot of farmers have tried this, is by taking one of the products on their farm and adding value to it, you know, processing it somehow.
Right.
And then selling that. Up here in Vermont, certainly there are many, many examples of that, of the people making, instead of selling the milk from the cow or the goat or the sheep, they're making cheese from it.
Right.
You know, or yogurt, or kefir, or whatever. And there are people who are, you know, also taking vegetables and making, you know, canned goods that they sell. So there are a lot of different possibilities for adding value, but it's almost like a different.
It's a different business. It's a different job. Yeah,
that's right.
It's a different set of regulations. Different set.
That's
of,
right. That's right.
Well, I know, and I'm going to apologize to you and our listeners right now. I know that we have way more to cover with you than the show's time is going to allow for. So hopefully, we'll be able to have you back on. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the events of 2008 and your book.
Okay,
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, welcome back to the Farm Report. We are live with Fred Magdoff. Fred, before the break, we were kind of setting the scene a little bit. I'd love to talk about 2008. What happened? In the 5 minutes.
Well, it's in a way, it's similar to what's happening right now. It just hasn't gotten quite so severe, but it's getting there. And that is the prices for the basic commodities, food commodities like corn and rice and wheat, and the cooking oils made from soy and from palm oil, from the palm oil tree, the oil palm tree. All of these went up drastically within a very short period of time. And this put a lot of pressure on people who are eating, you know, they're making porridge, or they're just cooking the rice and eating the rice, etc. Because many of those were spending 40, 50, 60% of their income on diet on food. Excuse me. And so, if food prices double as they did, you run out of money.
Yeah,
you know, to buy
fast,
quick. And so so what happened was you had some shortages. Not there was plenty of food. There was enough food to feed everybody well. But you did have, the supplies were tight because of problems of, in some countries there were droughts, in some countries there had been some floods. Australia wasn't exporting wheat or rice as they normally had done. And so then you got speculators jumping in. This happens at the local level with hoarding, and then you have this huge financial system. We now have speculation in agricultural goods. Is a big deal, and that's happening again. In other words, they figured they could make money off of speculating on food, so they will buy, you know, the right to a certain amount of food, and this drives the price up. And so, and also, we have a lot of food now which is going to feed animals per capita eating of meat products has gone up by 50% over a 20-year period, and we're now feeding, if you pardon the expression, automobiles through ethanol.
Right.
So, like a third of the crop, of the corn crop in the United States in 2007 went to produce ethanol, which is makes no sense whatsoever from an energy point of view, so it was diverted from the food system. So you have a number of things happening, and also you have concentration occurring in the suppliers for agricultural goods and the processors and distributors of agricultural goods.
You mean fewer companies are doing that work? Is that what
yes.
you mean by concentration? Okay.
Absolutely. Fewer companies are doing it. And you know, at whatever stage you look at, from just taking corn and doing something to it, or if you take it to the final stage, selling it to the end user, the consumer, you know, it's Walmart is, you know, by far the largest grocery seller in the United States. And they sell about 20% of all the food sold in this country. That's an incredible amount.
Wow.
To be done
I didn't realize it was that high.
Yeah, to be done by one store. I mean, one chain. It's not one store, obviously, but one company. So you put all that together, and you have a tight market, you got speculation, you got a few problems weather-wise, which drives the speculation even more, and you have a crisis. And this year, it's the, you know, the droughts in Russia last summer. Russia's become a major exporter of wheat. You had floods in Pakistan, which greatly affected a large number of people in the wheat and rice growing areas, and a few other places as well. You had these weather anomalies, shall we say, and so this has put a squeeze on prices. And corn is now over $7 a bushel. It was, I forgot what it was just not that long ago. It was like $4, and you've got you know, many of the other ones, the soybeans is up at, something like $14 a bushel.
And that
was when it was 10 or 9, you know, not 6 months ago. And so you have this tremendous pressure. Now, it's not felt that much in the United States yet.
Just to be clear, that extra $4 in price, or the doubling of price, that money's not going to the farmer. That's going to this kind of new...
Right.
Kind of collection
right.
of intermediaries who are essentially creating a new revenue stream for themselves. I mean, that's not going, I mean, it's not like the cost of production. I mean, or is it some of that, the cost of production has gone up, or the cost of, you know, like where is that price balloon is coming from, a variety of factors, or?
It depends, really.
On the commodity?
Farmers can many times sell their crop on the futures market. In other words, they can put it in storage and say, well, we're not going to sell it now. We're going to sell it, you know, if they have storage capacity at some further date. Or they can play the futures markets also. They can sell their crop now, but say they want to hedge, and so they can play the market like a speculator. But a lot of this money, of the increase that happens this quickly, doesn't go to the farmer. There were stories, by the way, from China. You know, cotton prices have gone up tremendously, and of cotton farmers who have just hoarded their cotton in their houses. They just have bales of cotton in their houses, waiting to see what happens to the price of cotton. So the speculation happens at local levels, and it happens in the large markets where you have, you know, what you think of as speculators,
right,
buying and trading these. They don't really want the product. They're just playing a game.
Well, similar to, like, the housing crisis,
yes,
where there's a lot of different players and a lot of people who are kind of not making great decisions lead to... Okay, great.
So basically what happens is once prices go up, I mean, it's the poor people that are hungry, and once prices go up, more and more people are less able to afford it. We have now 50 million people in the United States that are living in households that are considered to be food insecure, which is the USDA's way of saying hunger.
Yeah.
They don't use that term anymore. And there's over a billion people in the world who are really hungry and suffering from malnutrition. So this is a big issue. This is not small. And even when the prices come down some, you still have hundreds of millions of people that are hungry. So what happens in a crisis is, you know, there are people who come into this group that weren't in it before, and the ones that were in it, they're worse off than they were before. The group of hungry people I'm talking, of course.
Right.
So that's a thumbnail sketch of what happened. It's very complex. There are a number of issues that are long-term and short-term that are happening at the same time, and they go together to cause this. But we need to keep in mind that if the food that we have right now and in 2008 was equitably distributed around the world, there would have been plenty of food for everyone.
Okay, so it's, I mean, there is, from a production standpoint in the world, there's a pot of food that's big enough to feed everyone, essentially.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And do you feel like that's a, I mean, is that a story that's not getting told?
Well, in a way, anyone who gets involved in this and starts to just look at the numbers or anything, you know, they become aware of it very quickly because it's simple mathematics. There's more than enough grain produced to supply everyone with the basic diet for calories, and then you go to protein and other aspects as well. So I think it's, in a way, it's not talked about because of the reason behind it. The reason behind it is poverty, and we as a world and as a country, if you just talk about the United States, allow it to occur, and we have the means at our disposal. Clearly, in the United States, you don't have to look any further than this to eliminate hunger completely. And there should be no homes that are considered to be so-called food insecure in this country. It's a question of political will. And what happens is the poor people in general don't vote, or they don't vote in the same percentages as people who are wealthier. Right now in the Congress of the United States, there are a number of people who are more than willing to decrease any benefits going to poor people, and this is happening in state houses also, as their budgets are stretched. So what happens is the most vulnerable become even more vulnerable because they have no political clout, essentially none. And so it's relatively easy to just take away a program that helps poor people. Try to take away a program that helps wealthy people, and it's very difficult, as we've just found out.
Right.
You know, with the tax trying to decrease, you know, the tax cuts that the wealthiest of our country have, you know, people screaming and hollering. And they get the ear of Congress through lobbyists and other ways. So I think that story doesn't get every once in a while you hear it. That is, that there's enough food in the world to feed everyone. You don't hear it very often. You don't hear it explained in the way that I've explained it. Because I think it's challenging to the very way we set up our society and the very way we operate, in which people below, you know, a certain income level, it's, you know, they're on their own, you know, in general. You know, there's the food stamp program, which now has a different name, SNAP, but there are some programs that help. Of course, we have charities. I know that.
Right, but the social safety nets, I think, there's a lot of myths out there. I definitely would recommend our listeners in New York City to check out the New York City Coalition Against Hunger. They do a lot of really wonderful work and put together some kind of great information about the state of hunger and food insecurity here in New York. Let's shift gears a little bit, and kind of, we have a few minutes left. I want to get into essentially the book. It seems like can act as a primer for people who are kind of interested in getting, you know, on the ground kind of overview of understanding the agri-food crisis. You've grouped the book into a couple of sections. Can you maybe just touch base on some highlights there?
Well, sure. Basically, the first part of the book and the chapter that my co-editor and I, Brian Toker, wrote, sort of, that is really like an overview of the book and of the issues, even some issues that aren't covered in the book. But the first part after that overview is really trying to understand the food crisis. I mean, where did it come from? Put it in a historical context. How is it playing out in India? What's the role of so-called fair trade? The biofuels, now an issue we haven't talked about is this, the global land grab. So we have a chapter called "The New Farm Owners."
Yeah, I've read a little bit about that. Okay.
and then the globalization of agribusiness, how it's just increasingly taking over in the third world. So that sort of sets the background for what is happening and why it's happening from a global perspective that doesn't neglect the United States, but is much broader than the United States. Then the second part is really what is being done and what can be done. So there are chapters dealing with the struggle in Paraguay for a more sustainable agriculture. There's on land reforms. There's a very interesting chapter on what's happening in Venezuela, trying to build a new food system by Cristina Chiavioni and William Camacaro. And then there are there's an article, really, Miguel Altieri is probably one of the best-known agroecologists, it's called, scientist, of the ecology of agriculture. And his chapter is basically about what can be done on small farms, how agroecology implemented on small farms can lead to food security and food sovereignty. And there are a couple of chapters on energy issues, increasing energy costs, can we do things better? One of those chapters shows that organic agriculture uses quite a bit less energy than does conventional agriculture. There's a comparison between them. And then the last chapter is titled, Can Ecological Agriculture Feed 9 Billion People? Which is what's expected in the year 2050, 9.2 billion. And
you're like round down there.
yeah, that's right. Oh, just round, that's right. Well, a billion here, a billion there, or a tenth of a billion here.
Whatevs.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot more people right now. They're close to 7 billion in the world.
Right.
And it's expected that the population, if all the trends continue as they have been, which doesn't mean they will, it will end up at around 9 to 9.2 billion. And so the question is, can we feed those extra mouths? And Jules Preddy's that last article, and I think articles before that, make a case that we can, and we can do it in an ecologically sustainable way, and an ecologically sound way. But it means really a different system than what's being used now in the United States predominantly, and even what's growing up in other countries, like all these huge soybean fields in Brazil and now going into other countries, and Africa now, land being purchased by European corporations and by Arab countries.
I'm more familiar with the Middle East.
Yeah, they have oil money, to grow food for them, or to grow, worse than that even, is to grow Jatropha on tens of thousands of acres. This is an oil seed crop, which is not edible, and it's grown only for biofuels, to make biodiesel.
Wow. Fred, we are out of time. I'm pretty bummed out. I would love to have you back on to talk a little bit more in depth about the myriad of issues that we were only able to touch on. For our listeners, if you want to pick up Fred's book, you can get it at www.monthlyreview.org. And the title again is Agriculture and Food in Crisis, Conflict, Resistance, and Renewal. Fred, thank you so much for taking some time with us today, and we look forward to having you on the show again soon.
My pleasure, and I'd love to be back.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Momofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.